And it is 6 p.m. I'm going to do roll call and then we can do approval of minutes. All right, Brian?
Here.
Martin?
Here.
Lloyd?
Here.
Kelly?
Present.
And Robert?
Yes.
All right, and then we're going to pass down the approval of minutes.
Minutes? Did you guys vote to approve the minutes already?
Yeah.
To what I'm signing.
They did? At another meeting? So those were the meeting minutes that you guys, I believe, approved at the previous November meeting. And then last but not least, you want to your side. And then one other thing, because this is a comprehensive plan meeting workshop tonight, we need you guys all to print your names, please, as in attendance. We're going to have to submit that to the state. And then while you're doing that, that's all of the official business we have for you guys. So I'm going to turn it over to our consulting team, Ben Floyd and Adam Cares. But before I do that, as you guys saw in the memo from Ben and his team, we are starting to kick off the comprehensive plan work. And with that, we will be convening quite a bit more over the coming months and year to go through that, both in a workshop process, public hearing, and the formal process. So just be prepared to start convening a little bit more frequently than we have been in the past as we kind of enter into this busy season for Planning Commission. So with that, I will turn it over to Ben.
Great. Thanks, Michelle. Good evening, everyone. Can you hear me okay?
Yep. Yep.
Okay, awesome. So Ben Floyd, White Bluffs Consulting, located in the Tri-Cities, been working out in the Tri-Cities doing planning work for Benton County and lots of other counties and cities throughout Eastern Washington for the last 25 years. Also with me is Adam Cares with ACGO. So you're going to see some pretty cool maps in the PowerPoint presentation tonight. I didn't put those together. That was Adam. So anyway, Adam is working with us as part of the team, and we're happy to have him joining us tonight. Well, the purpose of tonight's workshop is to really give you an overview of where we're heading and remind you of some of the requirements that we have to address, or orient you, if you're not as familiar with them, to some of the requirements that we have to address. So I'm going to try sharing my presentation. It says I'm sharing already.
Ben, we're not seeing it.
Okay. So let me try this entire screen. Click share. All right. Now, can you see your meeting?
Yep.
Okay. So let me go to the PowerPoint and I'm going to go to slideshow. And now, are you able to see the slideshow?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. So I won't be able to see, you know, hands raised or anything because my screen is completely covered by the presentation. So I'll rely on Michelle. You can help me field questions as we go along, or just start talking and I'll stop talking. How's that?
Sounds good.
Okay. All right. So we're going to cover a couple different things. I've already introduced our team. We have several other team members that are helping us with pieces. There's a company called Burke Consulting that is helping us with the housing, land capacity analysis. JUB Engineers, also out of the Tri-Cities, is helping us with the transportation analysis for the plan. And so that's the main team members that are involved. So we're going to talk a little bit about the Growth Management Act and the comprehensive plan update process, hit some of the new requirements, talk about our plan for public input. It's a new and kind of updated approach that we are implementing consistent with the state grant requirements, and then talk about how we'll be coordinating with the Planning Commission in our next steps. And again, feel free to just ask questions as we go along. We want to keep this really informal. This is a general timeline that we've developed for updating the plan. You can see it ends here in June of 2026. We can actually go a little bit farther than that, but that's when the funding ends. And so that's the charge that Greg and Michelle have given our team, is to try and finish as much, if not all, of the work by June of 2026. So since November, we've been working on analysis of various elements that you'll hear about more in the presentation as we go along. Starting this summer, as we get into July, we'll start working more specifically on the plan, updating goals and specific policies. And some of that work may happen a little earlier, but generally most of it's going to happen in that kind of third quarter of 2025. And then 2025, September through February 26, when we've developed the draft plan, is really making sure we've updated all of the different elements of the comprehensive plan using the analysis and the direction on goals and policies that we've received up to that point. And then we're looking at March through June for adoption. Obviously, there will be lots of opportunities for public input throughout the process, largely using Planning Commission meetings, but there will also be other meetings, listening sessions, public workshops that we'll hold. You may or may not be aware of what the environmental review document is for the existing comprehensive plan, but it's an early 1980s environmental impact statement. And so Greg and Michelle asked us to develop a new environmental impact statement that's a little more high level, that doesn't quite have the same level of detail as the old EIS, and also is much more up to date than late 80s. And every time we've done a comprehensive plan update, we've also done a what we call a SEPA addendum, which is basically, you know, applying the analysis from the original EIS and verifying that it still covers the effects for the proposed actions. And their feeling was, hey, that document's probably outdated. We have the budget to be able to do it. So let's prepare a draft and final environmental impact statement is a companion to the comprehensive plan. So you'll have your comprehensive plan, development regulations, and then draft and final environmental impact statement. Any questions on this general timeline or comments? Anything Greg and Michelle want to have or add or Adam?
Nope.
Okay. All right. So the Growth Management Act, some of this stuff is review. I'm going to go through it kind of quickly, but this is the state RCW and the administrative code that comprises the Growth Management Act. There are mandatory elements that we need to address, but we could address those based on local conditions. And that is really true. What Benton County has in its comprehensive plan is much different from King County or Spokane or maybe even Okanagan County, based upon the conditions, right? So we take the county conditions and we address those elements through that process. So the plan gives you a framework for growth for the next six, in more detail, 6 years, and then an overall 20-year growth projection. And as I mentioned, the grant has a due date of 2026, June. We're trying to get that done by then. We do have legally, through the statute, up until December of 2026. These are the areas that we need to address in the Growth Management Act. So there's specific planning goals related to all of these. I'm not going to read these for you, but you can see the different topics that we address. Maybe just by show of hands, and Michelle, you can give me the number, but how many Planning Commission members participated in the last comprehensive plan update, which we also led for the county?
Three out of five.
Okay, good. So this is really review for at least three of you and hopefully reminders as well. And then for the other two, you know, we have to basically address specific requirements related to each of these planning goals. You know, and it's kind of interesting because some of these, like economic development and open space protection, may be, you know, difficult to kind of manage, but that's the way this law is set up, is to try and take all of these different goals and integrate them into a way that makes sense for Benton County. And the Planning Commission, you're going to have a real key role in helping identify what that balance should be amongst competing interests. There are some new state requirements that have come out in the last few years. These are probably the two biggest ones. Climate change and climate resiliency is now a new element in the plan. So you had 14 on the previous slide. In effect, we have another one that is a plan element. And so we are not working on that part of the project. So that's a different consultant. And it's a regional effort. So the county is working with the cities and towns. And remind me, Michelle, are you also working with Franklin County and Pasco? And
so there's five jurisdictions involved in the regional effort. The county, Kennewick, Richland, West Richland, and Pasco. Unfortunately, Franklin County, Prosser, and Benton City decided to go on their own to meet this requirement from the state.
I see. Okay. Thank you. So development of that element of the plan is on the same schedule as I showed you earlier, but we won't be bringing information related to that to you as a consultant team. It will be the consulting team that's working in that regional effort that will be providing that information to you. Or they'll provide it to us, we'll put it in the plan, and then share an overview as part of going over the overall plan. We still have to figure out some of those coordination details. I don't know if you want to add anything more to that, Michelle.
Other than we just kicked off with our first meeting on Monday, the state has required us to have a community advisory board. So we have about 40 members from the communities on that, and they're going to be helping the consultants do the work. We got funding from the state. So rather than each one of the jurisdictions spend their own allotment of money, we're saving money by pooling our resources together and doing one comprehensive plan, so to speak, for the region, especially since some of those issues that are highlighted in climate change emission and greenhouse gas emissions are regional, like transportation and cars going from Pasco to Hanford, or, you know, from Yakima to the Tri-Cities. We thought it would be a better approach. And so we're saving some money from that grant so we can do some implementation later on that. So we're just starting that process, kind of like we're starting the public process with Ben and his team as well. So we're hoping that we'll bring you guys something more on that in the coming months.
Michelle, I have a question for you.
Sure.
Regarding the climate change element, will we be hearing anything from the consultant on that?
I don't know if you guys are going to be hearing specifically from the consultants. We are going to have a couple of meetings. I think those are kind of broad meetings to get community interest. When we have some sort of document or plan or draft put together, I'm sure we as staff will be bringing that to you. Whether or not those consultants will join us at the Planning Commission meeting, I'm unsure of at this point, but I'll definitely keep you guys kind of in the loop as to other public meetings that are happening. Kelly?
What is the name of that consultant?
The consultant that's doing the work. So the primary consultant is called Cascadia, and then the sub-consultant is Burke. They're the two consultants that actually wrote the plan for the state, which requires us to have to do it locally. So the cities thought it was a good idea to go with the experts, so to speak, who wrote the guidance for the state.
That's a good segue into housing also, because Burke was also involved in helping develop the state guidance for housing, the new housing requirements. And that's why we brought them onto our team as well to get that expertise to help address the requirements. So for those housing requirements, you know, in the past we had to do just more of a simple land capacity analysis. So if you projected, you know, 10,000 new people coming in and you had a household size of 2.7 people per household, you know, how much additional land do you have that's zoned for, you know, residential and as well as industrial and commercial and all of that, and can you accommodate that growth? Now your focus more, we have to focus more on income bands so that you have housing for all sorts of different income levels. From maybe someone that can barely afford home, a housing situation, you know, like is maybe sharing roommates, sharing space with roommates in a multifamily situation, or is receiving subsidized home, subsidized housing, all the way up to affluent where they're building larger estates. The emphasis, of course, is on the lower part of the economic spectrum, the lower income bands. You also have to provide housing capacity for emergency housing. So, you know, emergency shelters, if there's a fire or if you have a high homeless population, you know, how do you address that? Permanent supportive housing. And then also implement policies and regulations to address and begin to undo racially disparate impacts, displacement, and exclusion in housing. And so it's new requirements. One of these situations where we're kind of trying to figure it out as we build the housing element. The state has some pretty good guidance that we're using. We're also working very closely with the cities. And it turns out that the county may not have as much of an impact, or let's see, may not be as much affected by this new housing requirement, because much of the housing will, by kind of practical requirement, need to go within the cities where you have transit and more urban services, access to healthcare and or health facilities and shopping and those type of things that, you know, if you were out in Plymouth or Patterson or even various times out in Findlay, because sometimes they have, you know, some facilities or some services, and other times they go away. Anyway, you wouldn't have access to those places, and that's part of the of kind of making sure that you have a comprehensive housing approach that considers not only, you know, housing units and what those might cost, but also location, infrastructure, services, all of that.
Could you go back to the last slide real quick?
You bet.
I was wondering if you could define that last term, permanent supportive housing. What does that mean?
So that's more of like maybe what Benton County is trying to do at the old Trios Hospital downtown Kennewick, where you've got permanent supportive housing maybe for drug rehabilitation or for you know, individuals that are transitioning and maybe working to be able to afford their own housing, and housing authorities in Kennewick and Richland also, you know, have like voucher programs, and I'm not a housing expert, but I know they have like assistance in Kennewick off of 4th and like Vancouver. There's a whole housing assisted housing area. So that is an example of a permanent supportive housing. So my guess is we've got a lot of that already in place. There may be additional needs that are identified through this process, but that's what that is meant to address. Does that help?
Yeah, that's what I thought. I just wanted to hear from somebody else other than my own thoughts.
Hey.
And like Ben said, you know, the state did outline, especially number two, we're projecting most of that to go into the city because of those other services that urban areas can provide. The other thing that I just wanted to mention is that the housing, the state came up with this tool where you implement data and information, but the main thing is that the housing is going to be allocated based on population. So the cities like Kennewick and Richland, who have the largest populations in our area, are going to have to carry the burden of most of this housing. And then, you know, smaller places like Benton City and Prosser, and then of course us, would have a little bit less of a burden to carry to meet those housing targets and requirements that the state's asking for. But again, most of the the emergency type things more than likely will be going into the cities, and we won't see that out.
Well, I would think they were already there.
Yeah, I think they are.
You have schools, you got churches, all sorts of emergency shelter capabilities. They just need some adjustments for an emergency, right, to handle capacity. What I don't want to see is, what I'd hate to see is, these kind of laws go into place, right? The plans go into place, and then they think they got to tax us to death and build something that sits there idle. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And so that makes me nervous.
Yeah, no, that's a good comment. And thanks, Michelle, for adding that detail. You know, what we'll identify for Benton County is like the different bands that the county provides currently. And then, you know, a continuation of that going forward. Obviously, there's a lot of higher income housing in the county as county land has become more expensive. So you've got, you know, small acreage farms or small acreage residential development. But you've also got some areas where you've got more affordable housing. And so it'll be kind of a, you know, we're providing, you know, income band for like 50% to 80% of the median income in these areas. And we're providing, you know, 100% or 120% of the median income plus in a lot of these other areas, and just identify, we'll need to identify the amount that we're going to continue to provide for the county would continue to provide going forward, you know, taking that population growth and dividing it up into those income bands that are appropriate for the county.
And the other thing too to remember is we are just planning for the housing. It's not a requirement to actually build or have anything built, but we just need to make sure that we have enough space and capacity for this if a developer wanted to come and do these types of projects. So again, we're just planning for this stuff and ensuring that it is available in the cities and the county. If somebody wanted to do, you know, lower income housing projects or apartment buildings or something like that, which, you know, would obviously go into the city and not the county, but that there's space available for that.
So would you be working with the city then in conjunction with that? Because we don't have sewer. So in order to get higher density than
we're not doing higher density in the county. Like I said, most of that stuff is going into the city. We're actually doing a regional approach to housing. So we're currently
like
meeting
unit development or something like that?
No, nothing like that. So we're meeting with all the cities right now, and we're trying to get a regional strategy of where all of these things will go to ensure that not just the county is meeting our targets, but the cities are too, kind of collectively as a whole. And again, we're not doing any multifamily or anything like that in the county because we're not allowed to based on zoning. All of that will be going in the city. I'm just saying that, you know, we have to be able to provide what we can provide based on each one of our regulations. So the best we could do for, you know, density or places that we could have duplexes, which aren't very many places in the county, unfortunately, and that sort of thing. So kind of get innovative to the best that we can. Unfortunately, like Ben was saying, the county is kind of the redhead stepchild in this process because it's really targeted towards the cities because they have more flexibility to have these larger scale projects or these, you know, multifamily units or these lower income units because they have bus services and other services there in the city and sewer and water. I don't foresee us having that be an outcome of the work we're going to do with Ben and his team just because the county's not set up to handle that.
Well, the state's really pushed the county into that type of situation. It used to be you could do planned unit developments, you could develop a Class A water system, and you could have your own sewer, on-site sewer, and you could develop high density and residential in the county.
That's still an option, yep. Developers just don't want to do that. We still have planned unit developments in our zoning codes, so that's still an option. Nobody just is choosing to spend the money on
that. Nobody's wanting to spend the money to go that large.
That's right.
The city and the county work together to identify areas that the city could annex to meet these goals?
We're not there yet. I don't think so. The cities are still in the process of analyzing their land capacity. So they're out trying to figure out how much land they have and what they need. And then if they're needing to annex some of their urban growth areas, they may do so. We don't anticipate them doing that through this process, but they may in the future.
Right. That could be one of the implementation actions that comes out of a strategy, for example. great discussion. I don't want to close it off if there's any other questions about housing. Otherwise, I'll keep moving forward. So one of the other requirements is we had to send an invitation just to the Yakima Nation, but we also sent it to the Umatilla Confederated Tribes, Umatilla Indian Reservation, inviting them to be more closely involved in our planning effort. And we haven't heard back from the Umatillas, but the Yakima Nation has said that they would just like to do informal coordination like they have in the past. And so we're working with John Marvin on their staff that will be involved. And so they'll be reviewing the draft plan. So when we send you information, we'll be sending that to the tribe as well. You know, we have draft plan elements that we're going to be working on. And we'll also extend that same opportunity to Umatillas. So those are the state requirements. We've also identified some local priorities, and these have come from a combination of our grant requirement, which I guess is still a state requirement, but then also local priorities that Greg and Michelle have shared with us. So one of the things that we're going to be doing is more targeted outreach and providing Spanish translation services at our public meetings. And we have a couple of Spanish interpreters that are on our team that will be helping us with that. And then we're looking at an energy overlay, and this is some of the work that Adam has been working on recently, and I'll show you a few examples of that and let him speak to that here in just a few minutes. But trying to figure out where future energy projects might go, recognizing there's already been a lot proposed in Benton County, but as we go forward, if energy projects continue, where and how would those be provided for in the county? Another thing that we're keeping trying to get a closer handle on is the protection of shrub steppe habitat, and looking at potentially identifying a mitigation program that can be used to offset impacts so that as development occurs in the county, we have an area that we're protecting for shrub steppe habitat to help offset those impacts. We're also looking at, industrial lands, and are there any additional industrial land designation that should occur, or do we look at something more specific in the ag lands where we identify some ag/industrial lands? Right now, ag-related industrial is allowed in the GMA ag zone. And so we're looking a little more closely at industrial lands. And then the last area is we're working with Public Works to do some refinements for their capital improvement planning process to make sure that they meet the latest requirements for the state. And so we're working with Robert Blaine and Public Works on developing an improved capital improvement planning process that will be used to update this next year. The capital plan that will be developed later in 2025 for 2026 and beyond. Greg, Michelle, are there any other local priorities that you want to highlight for the Planning Commission? Then I want to ask the Planning Commission if there's anything else that you think needs to be addressed as part of this update process.
Nope. As Ben went over, you know, a big one for us is the energy overlay with the amount of renewable energy projects we've been seeing go through the state process. And then the other big one is the shrub steppe program. That's kind of been a piecemeal program that the Benton Conservation District had started. And we are, again, working as a region to try to get kind of a regional program going. So that's in the process. So we're hoping that'll get tied up and be able to be addressed in the comprehensive plan. That way we can kind of save some of our open rangeland and shrub steppe habitat that is getting converted to housing projects or renewable projects or whatever it may be. And then the industrial lands one is pretty important for us right now, just because the county doesn't have that much industrial land compared to like Pasco and Kennewick. And we really want to analyze if there's some places or if we have a need to increase industrial land in some of those areas. Right now, our biggest area is out in Findlay near the fertilizer plant, and then a little bit around Prosser as well, but we just don't have a whole lot. So we're taking a look at that to see if that might be an area where we might need to do some rezoning to increase some of that to allow industry to come in to the county.
Wasn't Christensen looking at trying to do some industrial sites up there on his property?
Mr. Christensen's property got taken into the city of Kennewick, and I believe that's industrial land for the city.
Yeah.
But he, him, what he owns now in unincorporated county is not. It's
not in the county anymore.
Yeah, and he doesn't have quick access to water until the city comes, so that might be one of the potential areas. Yeah. So we'll have to just see what the analysis comes back with after Ben and his team looks at that.
Which piece did he move into the city?
The piece just directly south of I-82.
I-82 makes the turn right there and then drops down on the south side of it, or southwest corner.
You know right where they do the dog tiles?
395 and 182.
Locust Grove on the top side, 397.
On that side. Yeah,
all that area down there. Okay.
I think we saw plans submitted by the city that they were going to extend a sizable water main out to that area.
Yeah, I think there was some adjustment, boundary review hearings and all kinds of stuff. They got called from Spokane, say, hey, you can't do that.
And yeah, so there, I think there that was mitigated pretty out. Yeah, they're still in that land is still in the city. They won that court case, so I'm sure they're going forward with their development plans, but it will probably take some time to get water and sewer out there.
Okay.
Anyway,
pardon my ignorance and the awkward, I guess, way that I'm going to ask this question, but we have so much agricultural land within the county. Is there a specific portion of this plan that pertains to agricultural lands? And is there representation from the producers and the farmers?
So in the last comprehensive plan in 2018, we actually had the exact same analysis done for agricultural lands. Mm-hmm. So in 2018, Ben and his team did the exact same thing for ag. We looked at all of our agricultural land based on the criteria that the state has set out for us, and we either added ag land or took ag land out, depending on what is actually existing on the ground and then what some of the data points looked like. And so we did that analysis in 2018, so we're feeling pretty strong still about that. And ironically, Greg and I use that as the backbone of why we argue against the renewable energy projects, because it doesn't meet the test. It met the test to put it in ag, and it should remain ag, and we're meeting what the state is requesting of us. And so we use that analysis for that. And so that's a pretty strong document that we already have in our comp plan. Cool. So
great explanation.
Yeah, and that's been so helpful in the 2018 process to now to be defensible, you know, in legal battles, not that we're winning on the renewable sides, but it's been so great to have that tool that we decided, you know, to have it for industrial lands would be really helpful going forward too, should something come up where we need kind of a backbone to rely on to say, hey, we did an analysis and we feel pretty strongly that we are at a competent area, or this land is a good match for that because of all of these things. Great. So it's a really nice tool to have. It's just they're very, very expensive. And we're really fortunate that we got a lot of money in this 10-year cycle this year from the state to do a lot of these extra things. These are all, I would say, extras that we probably weren't able to afford in the 2018 update. So I feel pretty fortunate that we got that much money from the state to be able to kind of cover our bases and do a few of these extra programs and analysis to kind of have that going forward, because it's a pretty good tool to use for us when we're trying to justify, you know, what we're doing and why we're developing in the ways that we are.
Okay, thank you.
And maybe just to add on to that, and thanks for those comments, Michelle. So you'll see here in just a few minutes as we give you a few of the preliminary energy overlay maps that we're looking at that Adam has developed. You'll see that we factored in the findings from that 2018 ag lands, both the kind of criteria that we used and then the outcomes of those ag land designations as we look at energy opportunity areas or areas where energy doesn't make a lot of sense. So we're definitely considering that along with habitat and species. So are there any other local priorities that you think we should be addressing as part of this comp plan update, Planning Commission members?
I haven't seen the new revised comp plan, so when I see what's happening, what we're proposing, then I might have some questions.
Hey, and that's great. So mainly I just wanted to pose that question because we're going to be providing you a lot of information of things that we think are important or things that we know we have to do to address state requirements. But if there are other priorities that you hear about, that you think about, you know, as you've done your work or as you do your work going forward, you know, really we want to hear that kind of between now and maybe like September so that we have some time to address it, right? If you bring us something next April, you know, a year from now and we're in the adoption process, harder to change. But really over the next 3 to 6 months, if you can help us with any additional local priorities, we would welcome that input and guidance from you. Okay, so one thing to, one of the planning commissioners just mentioned that, hey, they need to see what the 2018 plan looks like. We encourage all of you to go back to that 2018 plan, review it, get familiar with it, flag areas where you've got questions or comments or whatever, because that's what we're starting with. We're not rewriting a new plan. We're taking that 2018 plan and we're extending the planning horizon out, you know, the next 20 years, right? And we're updating it with state laws and case law requirements, best available science for critical areas regulations, addressing all these different requirements, but based on the existing plan. And if there's things that we need to update in that plan just that, you know, to make more sense or whatever, we want to do that as well as part of the update. So we kind of talked about this one. You know, this is why we plan, but, you know, it's a rolling update. And so now we'll be doing these every 10 years. And so you have to plan for kind of the next 10 years, what's happening, where are the issues, where's the growth occurring? And so you get these issues to kind of accumulate, and we do this comprehensive rewrite, or rather comprehensive update, to address those issues. So that's why we plan, and it'll be a process that goes on and on. This just shows you the Growth Management Act, how it provides the legal basis for the plan. The plan provides the goals, policies, and the environmental review that then also supports the development regulations. So the comprehensive plan and the development regulations are consistent. And then implementation happens really through Greg and Michelle and their team's work at the counter, at the time of decision for permit, at the planning commission, hearing examiner, all of that is part of the implementation process. This just shows, you know, that we consider public input, the future of the county, county policies, the state requirements, and all that gets factored into the plan and development. Michelle talked about population. This is preliminary, but kind of what we're using as a starting point. So you can see the county in 24 had just about 218,000 people broken up between the cities and the unincorporated part of the county. In 2050, we're looking at about 70,000 more people over the next 25 years. And you can see that 36 and 33%, the largest percentages, are going into Kennewick. The county is the next largest, and West Richland. And then Prosser and Benton City make up a few percent. We have to figure out how we're accommodating this growth and where it's going to occur and how it's going to be serviced and all of that. That's part of the planning effort.
I have to ask this, Michelle, a question.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Ben, let me go back to the population.
Go back to that previous slide. So in our previous comp plan, we had the projection for population. How does this line up with what our projection was? It seems to me like this is a lot higher than what we had projected before, even on the highest
level. No, it's tracking. So when we start looking at population, we get numbers from the Office of Financial Management. So they have a low projection.
Low, which medium, and high.
Yeah, right. Low means you're growing really slow. Medium's, you know, about average or in the middle. And then high is pretty high growth. And historically, since I've been with the county, we've kind of teetered between medium and high. That's actually notching down a little bit now. We're trending right at the medium area. I would say that might be actually going down a little bit too, based on what we've been seeing on a building permit level and that sort of thing. I'm not sure that we're getting that high growth that we saw during the pre-COVID and the COVID years. As far as what our population projections were, the last comp plan, the biggest changes are actually to the city of Kennewick. I believe Kennewick was 40% of our allocation historically. So they're dropped down. City of Richland is expanding, obviously, with the Ballinger South project. And then West Richland is growing quite a little bit as well. The county lost some of our population to balance that out. So both Kennewick and the county has decreased. Richland and West Richland are growing. I'm sure everyone's kind of seen that development occurring out on site in both of those areas. And then Prosser and Benton City are remaining the same as well. Benton City had requested to be a little bit higher because they are growing as well. But compared to the growth of the other cities, they're growing. They're just not, you know, able to make up a whole percentage to be able to get that from the bigger cities.
So when you count growth, you count, like, if somebody's got a 300-unit apartment complex, that's one permit, right? But you've got a house.
No.
That's one permit, too.
No. I didn't. So for us in the county, it's generally a one-to-one type of scenario, not necessarily because, as Ben mentioned, average house is about 2.5. But I was just referencing that we've been seeing quite a decline in building permits coming in.
Sure.
And so that generally means growth or new development is slowing down. The OFM takes population based on the number of people. They don't. And that comes from the census, so it normally goes with the census. So it doesn't matter how many houses are there. It's based on the number of people that they've captured.
Well, what's happened is the way that the state has allocated our zoning requirements, where we now can't do 3 residences on a 1 acre. Okay, now we can, the smallest we can get is 1 acre lots in the county. We used to be able to get 3.5 lots per acre based on the health department's requirements, not the state's requirements, okay? So it's all turned around. So now we're being dictated from the state what we can do, not from the county, not from the health department that says, hey, you know, you can put a septic tank on a third of an acre, and you still can, okay? But now they say, no, you can't do that, okay? You have to go to the city. So now the county has been allocated to a holding resource for the city, which I don't think is right. I'm just pushing that out to you. And I'd like to push back on that a little bit, because I think we would see a whole lot more growth if we could get those 3 lots per acre in the county.
Okay.
Great. Thank you. And we were able to get some 1 acre unit growth in the last update, but we're not anticipating being able to do that this go around. The other thing I wanted to note here is that it shows, you know, the population going up another 70,000, but the growth rates in Kennewick and Richland, you know, overall that ends up being like 1.25% growth rate if you take it just for the county overall. But more of that growth is going to go in Kennewick, Richland. Their rates are going to be higher. The county rate's going to be a little lower. West Richland's rate is actually going to be pretty high. So that 12% is not their annual growth rate. Their annual growth rate will be quite a bit higher than that. And same with Benton City. So it's the cities are going to see higher percentages of growth, higher than 1.25%, and the county will be, you know, a little less than that.
Obviously, it's Franklin County, but how does Pasco's growth number compare to Kennewick?
I don't know. I haven't seen their numbers. We generally don't look outside of our county, but Pasco has been growing exponentially as well.
Yeah, sure.
So I would assume that Pasco is probably a little bit higher than Kennewick or between Kennewick and Richland.
Percentage-wise, it is the fastest growing county in the state.
But the interesting thing about Franklin County, and Greg can speak to this because he worked at Franklin County for a long time, is that Pasco is really their only major city. So that's a huge population for them. So I'm sure their scale is Pasco has a majority of the growth, and then unincorporated county and some of those smaller enclaves like Mesa and Othello and those areas have a much smaller, you know, population. Right. So, but Greg, if you wanted to speak to what
the population for unincorporated Franklin County, I believe, is only around 13,000 people. And so the majority of Franklin County is in their urban growth areas and inside the city limits of Pasco.
Yeah, copy. Thanks for indulging that.
Yeah, like I said, I'm sure it's 75% in Pasco in their urban growth area, and then, mm-hmm. you know, the remaining little bits in the other cities. But I could certainly reach out and ask if you were interested in looking at
it. Just curious what the numbers look like.
Yeah. Sorry, Ben, go ahead.
Oh, no worries. We can certainly get that information to you. So these are the one of two maps that Adam put together as part of our energy overlay evaluation. So this is showing ag lands, and we'll come back to this here in a second. And this is looking at habitats and species. And, you know, I mentioned that kind of the first part of the plan is a bunch of analysis. And so we're heavy into the analysis right now for this, for housing, for other topics. So I just want Adam to just give you a quick overview of what's shown on this map and how we're going to use this information to build a memorandum that we'll share with the Planning Commission about what we're going to be proposing for an energy overlay and how that rolls into like zoning and future regulation. Adam, you up for that?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Ben. Good to be here talking to everybody. Looking forward to working with you all. As Ben mentioned, we've been tasked with evaluating the end use considerations related to the siting of utility scale energy facilities, particularly solar and wind generation facilities. As you all probably know, Benton County has had significant interest in these types of projects over the past several years. And the siting of these facilities really merits very careful consideration and planning as the county seeks to protect its valuable farmland, sensitive habitats. You can see in that second map, there's a significant extent of those. And then also just the health, safety, quality of life of the local communities in the county. And this first map here kind of provides us a summary of the agricultural lands. And Ben and Michelle mentioned the 2018 ag lands analysis that was done. And a lot of this work is actually building on that. We're trying to stay consistent with that in looking at and coming up with a summary of the county's agricultural land base and the agricultural lands that we want to protect in our eventual guidance and recommendations that we'll provide for the siting, potentially the siting of energy facilities. So this map shows kind of a number of layers stacked on top of each other. The really bright green is irrigated ag lands from the Washington State Department of Agriculture. And then underneath that, you see some dark green. This also includes prime farmlands, then also farmlands of unique local and statewide importance. And then it also includes capability classes. So the higher capability agricultural lands. So really I think provides a good starting point that shows both where agricultural activities, both irrigated and non-irrigated, are occurring in the county, where that existing base of activity is, and then also the valuable soils and where resources exist in the county for the long-term viability of agriculture into the future. Any questions on that first map?
You might just, I'll just note that this, oh, go ahead.
Sorry, Martin, go ahead.
He didn't hear me because no. We were muted, right?
I know, we were trying to figure it out.
Okay,
sorry.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, yep. We can hear you.
Okay. My question was, is how do you determine agricultural valuable land with unirrigated property?
It's really based on on non-irrigated lands. In this case, we're leaning on soils. So we use NRCS. They have soil capability classes, and that really is in keeping with the county's comprehensive plan and the criteria used to identify agricultural resource lands. So it's the same methodology that was used in the comp plan. And then it also builds on that 2018 methodology that the county used to evaluate which lands should stay in agricultural zoning and which lands might come out.
Okay, so as compared to Franklin County, where 90% of their ground is agricultural, when you're west of 395 over there, and we have almost no agricultural until irrigated agricultural, except you've got large farms that pump from the river. So do you make a distinction between irrigated and non-irrigated and
yes
classes?
Light green, dark green.
Yeah, that's light green and the dark green. And you've got all the horse heaven and parts of SVID and then other irrigation districts that serve in here as well. And then you've got all the circles. I mean, if pumping and water availability weren't an issue, I'm pretty sure all of this area would be irrigated because it's prime farmland, it's high suitable soils, and that's why you have pretty high production dry land. It's also upper elevation, so it allows for a little more moisture holding in the soil as well.
So essentially on this particular map, and I know it's not super zoomed in for you guys, but anything that has color on it would have some classification or justification for being ag land. The only sections that we identified when we looked at it a little bit more closely is if you look between the Watoma Solar Project in the on the western border of the county up in the north and the Hop Hill Project just below that, there's a little bit of a gray area or a tan area. That's the only area that we really identified that doesn't have any sort of bearing on ag. We didn't find a lot of other large tracks. So any of that light tan, which I know looks a lot like the Hanford area too, so okay, just ignore Hanford. But that light tan area are things that wouldn't be classified as ag right off of the gate. And then the next one that Adam's gonna show is habitat. So the ag priority and then the habitat, which is also important for siting renewable projects, okay, are the two. And so we're in the process of kind of overlaying those together and figuring out the spots.
Because that's been a problem in the past, you know, when we, some of the owners wanted to develop their property and it was being said that they have valuable agricultural ground when in fact, you know, they got 15 bushels per acre, which you can't live on 15 bushels per acre on farm ground, okay, that they were not allowed to turn that into something other than farm ground.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah, there's a lot of other classifications of ag besides productive irrigated ag land, which still needs protection and, you know, the ability to be ag land, whether it's rangeland for running cows or whether it's wheat. And I know that, you know, yields go up and down and that sort of thing, but it still warrants that protection. So we have to meet those thresholds of
protecting it. Well, I understand, but we're not the pollutes. We don't get 110 bushels per acre on our ground.
We certainly don't. We certainly don't. If you look at like the ag land, so one of the things that we did last go around, so here's 397 where it comes into Interstate 82. If you can see my cursor right below Kennewick, there was a lot of CRP and there still is a lot of CRP ground, Conservation Reserve Program. Sure. So that area is lower precipitation, right? 6 to 8 inches. But you get up here around Jump Off Joe and you're looking 18, 20, 22 inches. The yields vary substantially just in a few miles. So that's one of the reasons we were able to declassify some of the Christensen ground that was mentioned earlier, and be able to then set the stage for bringing that into the city of Kennewick because it was lower elevation, lower yield property. But this upper stuff is still pretty good, particularly on this backside. Yeah, you get some wind erosion, but there's still more moisture, holds longer, higher yield. So relative, and it's for Benton County, right? This is relatively better dry land soil. And if you could put irrigation to it, it would be awesome irrigation water, right? It's just a matter of if you want to pay the pumping costs or someone to pay the pumping costs. But this is getting a little far off of the wind and solar. And I know we're also bumping a little bit up into our time, but this second map that Adam has put together shows, you know, all of the habitat, which kind of fills in all the other voids that is not agriculture. We met with the state today, State Fish and Wildlife, and they said that, hey, this may give you kind of a false impression that there's no room for additional energy projects in the county between these two maps. It's either ag or it's habitat. That's generally true, but there are also like micro areas that have been developed kind of similar to this Wallula Gap solar project, where there could be other projects that could go in even just a few hundred acres and still be viable for providing, you know, utility based power. And so what we'll be doing over the next few months is putting together a memo that covers our analysis, some of our findings, and our recommendations for how to do an energy, a renewable energy overlay that makes sense for Benton County, that, you know, preserves ag land, preserves high quality habitat, but also provides opportunity where they exist under certain terms and conditions for being able to provide future energy projects. And so that's really the kind of the where this process is heading. Let me just pause there and see if Adam, if you had any kind of final thought to share before we move on.
No, I think you got it, Ben. It's a balancing act, as you can see from the maps. There aren't that many gaps when you know, at sort of first glance when you look at the data. So it really takes kind of a little bit more nuance and detail to identify those sites where there might be room to do something that's still at a significant scale, but again, factors in those key considerations that we want to balance with the need for renewable energy.
Well said, Adam. Thank you. Were there any other questions or comments from the Planning Commission before we move on? Okay. So where do we go from here? So we have this meeting tonight, which is your introduction. The next time we plan to get together with you is to conduct a scoping hearing, or I'm sorry, a scoping public comment meeting for the EIS that I mentioned earlier. We're planning to do that on April 8th. We'll be getting notices and other information to Greg and Michelle so that can get published, notification out and all of that for the EIS. And then over the summer, we'll be meeting with you to share the energy overlay analysis memo, share with you what we've developed with the cities on the housing front, critical areas review, what we learned from the SEPA scoping process, and probably some other topics. We're covering a lot of things in this update this go around. And so, but those are kind of the main things that you'll hear about in the summertime. And then in the fall, we've got some public open houses where we'll be taking input on the plan and sharing again some of the information like we previously shared with you. We'll be looking at some alternative land use scenarios that will set the stage for the EIS, and then draft updates to goals and policies. And then December, we'll be sharing some updated review updates to land use and other plan elements. And that's the work plan generally for this year with the Planning Commission. And then, like I mentioned earlier, 2026 will largely be focused on kind of addressing comments, finalizing documents. You hold your hearing, you make your recommendation, and then we go through the adoption process after that. So any other questions or comments on what we've shared tonight?
When will these maps be available to us?
They'll be available to you later this spring. We can send you the maps right now, but we're still working on them, which is why I'm hesitant to do it until we put the memo with the maps all together into a draft. But we can share that draft with you ahead of that June, July meeting, maybe even, you know, by late March or April sometime.
That'd be great, because you asked for our input, and it's pretty hard to give you input if we don't have those maps in front of us to look at them.
Fair enough. There will be a whole series of maps that will be put together for the update process. So these are just a couple of the maps.
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. Any other questions? Oh, go ahead.
You'll be sick of maps by the time we're done with this.
Yes. Except for Adam. He never gets tired of them.
I'll just jump in and thank Ben and Adam for taking the time out tonight to kind of kick this process off. It's going to be a pretty crazy next year and a half for all of us. So we've got a lot of information getting poured onto the Planning Commission, which I think we're excited about, and kind of excited to see these maps and kind of see how it's going to look on the ground. So we appreciate you guys' time tonight.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity. We'll be back.
And then just looking forward, Ben, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't believe we have a Planning Commission meeting in March that we need to hold.
Correct.
But we do have one in April. So right now it's scheduled for April 8th. And our plan is to do our SEPA scoping hearing. So we'll be talking about kind of the environmental impacts that the comprehensive plan may have.
We'll consider, yep.
Yeah, and so please add April 8th to your calendars. We'll probably definitely need a quorum for that. So Brittany will be reaching out and pestering you all. April 8th, yep.
You know, that is youth turkey season, I'm just saying.
We can't work around your turkey season for all your hunting season. And then just outside of the long range stuff that Ben has gone over and everything, I have had a couple of meetings on potential subdivisions, so we may be bringing other business, normal business, to you guys as well if those subdivisions end up coming in. So just be aware that we may have some other meetings here and there between these fun long-range projects. So
I saw you had several meetings.
Yes, we have. Those are the long range ones.
Right.
But like I said, we'll have a couple other meetings here and there if those subdivisions end up coming to fruition. So I think that's all that we have on the docket for you guys in, you know, the coming months. And it's not too much.
Open houses, all those kinds of things.
Yeah, the open houses, you guys can choose to attend if you'd like to. You don't have to. It's not required. But we definitely have a lot of things on the go to kind of get the word out to the greater public as well, besides just having these public hearings. So
okay. And just notify us the date and time of the open houses. And
okay, yep, we can do that.
Location.
Okay, yeah, no problem. Okay. All right, thanks, Ben.
Hey, one quick comment. So when we have these meetings, like where we're doing workshops with you, if we have members of the public, we would like at the end of each meeting to just see if anyone would like to make public comment about what we're sharing with you, if we have time for that or just plan for that. I don't know that we need to do that tonight, but I'm just saying, like, obviously the April meeting will be all about that, but like the workshops in June or July, you know, where we'll be going over some information, we want to publish those as public meetings. So encourage the public to attend and provide input. And I think folks can join virtually from anywhere, right? But they can also, isn't there a room in the,
yeah.
Well, I guess, yeah, you'll have your location there and then people can also join virtually. So just be thinking about that as a kind of a meeting approach with a hybrid approach for receiving public input as we go forward in the planning effort.
All right. Thanks, Ben.
All right. Thank you. Have a good rest of your evening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, everybody.